Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Robert Campbell from the Eating Disorders Foundation of Canada. So tell me a little bit about the Eating Disorders Association.
Well, it's called Eating Disorders Foundation of Canada, and we set it up in 1995. The reason we set it up, because there were a lot of gaps in terms of treatment, a lot of gaps in research, a lot of gaps in education, and we felt there was a real need to try and help raise awareness and to raise funds to try and help supplement those issues.
So, in terms of the eating disorders themselves, which ones are most common in your experience?
Well, the ones we deal with most are the ones that have very low BMIs, who have major food restriction problems, major body image problems that they all do, fear of control, and typically they're more anorexic because their BMI goes below 18.5, and if it's 17.5, you're 15% below your normal body weight, and traditionally young women will not have periods, and obviously interfering with their hormonal system, etc. Those are anorexia nervosa. A group in between would be called bulimia nervosa. And that is when people would eat food and bring food up. And this purging activity can be taking food in and bringing it up. The purging activity can be taking laxatives to try to purge yourself the other way. It can be in the form of exercise, and it can be in the form of diet pills, etc. So This is very difficult because your electrolytes get thrown out of balance and you often have cardiac issues, and there are many side effects with anorexia and bulimia. The other end of the scale is binge eating disorder, and it's often been equated. People would call someone obese or overweight, and part of the problem in losing weight is not addressing the psychological part of weight gain. And if you don't do that, you're not going to be able to keep weight off. So there's a psychological component to it, and estimates is like 25, as high as 25 or 50% of obese people also have a binge eating disorder component. So that's the third most common one, and those are the ones we deal with most.
So how do you go about dispelling the myths or stigmas surrounding eating disorders?
You've asked a very, very great question, and one that we're trying to struggle with even as we speak. So the Eating Disorders Foundation of Canada, how do we erase that stigma? How do we look at, you see the models that sort of portray themselves, the movie stars, the underlying message is that thin is beautiful. So the media portrays this body image by people who suffer with an eating disorder. So they have to lose weight to be able to portray themselves to the public who see what's happening, and they can adopt some of that. So there's that component of it, trying to be like them, and that there's a misconception out there that then is. There's also a genetic factor, so body shape, body weight, and I think the genetic factor too is appearing to be more related to an OCD component, like an obsessive compulsive sort of component, where you don't know what part of that obsessionality will be expressed. It might be through drinking, it might be through eating difficulties, it might be through gambling, all those kinds of things. There are, with eating disorders, there's a big comorbid factor, i.e. the eating disorder can appear with depression. It can appear with any disorder, and it can often be masking post-traumatic stress disorder. On top of the OCD picture, can be equated also, you might be having bipolar and an eating disorder at the same time. So the comorbid factor is horrendous. And you've got to remember that with anorexia, for instance, it has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness.
So in your time with the Eating Disorders Foundation, has there been any success that stood out for you?
I think the success is now we're trying to embark on a true national involvement. I think the success we've had is being able to help, being able to get some residential treatment off the ground. We've been able to help with a little bit of research. But we're not nearly where we should be in terms of how do you coordinate the provinces, how do you coordinate the each individual communities, and how do you equate that with the federal government, and how do you equate that with the person who suffers with an eating disorder and the families. There has to be some sort of amalgamated or collaborative approach to everything. It can't be the expectation of one group of people or one body of government to be able to handle all. So I think right now we're in the throes of trying to coordinate some of the various groups in Canada. So there are many groups. There might be one that's in Windsor. There might be one like in Sarnia. There might be one in London. And they're all over the country, but they're independent. And they operate oftentimes in a silo, all wanting to do something good. But somehow we're missing the boat if we were all to get together and make a national campaign, much like the Cancer Society of Canada. It would be, I think, a direction that we need to go to improve awareness and also address that stigma issue that you referred to.
In terms of the need to get a national campaign going, if you could send any message about the need to raise awareness on eating disorders, what would you say?
I think if a national message is how urgent it is, how it's swept under the rug, how it's masked, and its severity is very much underestimated. It is not being identified. It's much more prevalent in society than we'd like to acknowledge because people hide it. They don't want to come out and discuss it, and they're very difficult to try and treat, and people avoid it. So what I think the message we want to get is that we need more research. We need more treatment, and we need earlier detection. We have to start looking at this thing in public and high schools and universities, and we need younger people to see it. And we need folks out there to look and see, whoa, this isn't something just eat. They think out there that this is something they do by choice, and it's not. There are many, many background factors that we alluded to.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
Again, I'm amazed by some of the myths surrounding eating disorders, especially the myth that what's thin automatically must be beautiful. Fact of the matter is, life is beautiful. And people, society has no right to say whether a person can contribute something based on one physical characteristic. That sort of discrimination is exactly what the myths and stereotypes of disability life are all about. When you look beyond the obvious, you start to see that a person is more than just one factor. It's up to each of us to say, how important is this one aspect? Is it going to be all that we choose to see? Are we going to choose to look at this person and say, their weight's a little different than mine, so I'm not going to get to know them because I have this one trait that I find undesirable in them? Or are we going to choose to spend some time with them, get to know who they are as a person? Because I guarantee with any person with any type of disability or any difference whatsoever, they're more than just one factor. They're a person with hopes and dreams and aspirations and even experiences. That's the thing about people. If you spend enough time with them, you'll find they'll make you laugh, they'll make you cry, they'll even make you think. But not if you choose simply to label a person based on one little thing. Myths and stereotypes surrounding eating disorders and any other disability are just antiquated thinking, in my opinion. We as a society pride ourselves on all the wonderful advancements of the past 150 years, but the truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter nearly as much if human understanding doesn't grow along with the technology the understanding of medical science. We, as a people, need to keep an open mind. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned. The Downtown Music Initiative is providing a unique opportunity for young people to learn and to thrive from music in the community.
The DMI is a community program that offers free music lessons to students ages 4 to 17 who come from low-income families. It's run by volunteer musicians.
How can I get more information on the DMI?
You can contact me, Melissa Miner, at 226-347-6409 or visit our Facebook page, Downtown Music Initiative.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Robert Campbell from the Eating Disorders Foundation of Canada. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Carrie Bruder, Ontario Director for the Canadian Diabetes Association. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with the Canadian Diabetes Association.
Sure. Well, I have been involved with the association for close to 25 years now, and I have really seen this organization grow from being a much smaller organization to being really a national organization that is striving to serve the needs of the 10 million people in Canada who either have diabetes or pre-diabetes. So it's been quite a journey, seeing where the association, has grown to and how we have been able to, I think, really respond as time goes on to the needs of people with diabetes. As you may know, we support diabetes research on an annual basis to the amount of close to $7 million a year. And over the last many years, we've contributed upwards of $125 million to some of the best diabetes research in the world, which takes place here in Canada. So it's been really interesting to see that happen over the years. Our focus on research is not only for a cure, although that's certainly always a highlight for us, but we also ensure that we are supporting research for people to live day-to-day lives better. And we've seen over the years how people who are managing their diabetes well have really been able to lessen the impact of complications of diabetes, which are really pretty severe. It includes, you know, heart attacks, strokes, blindness, amputations, kidney failure. So it's it really is a disease to be reckoned with.
So how does the association go about spreading the word about the work they do?
Well, we do it through a number of ways. We have branches right across the country in all of our provinces. We have local and regional staff who put on diabetes expos, learning series. We do health fairs. We do interviews just like this on both radio and TV. So the people are aware of the work that we do. We also use social media, as well as we have quite a robust website that we direct people to. So we try and use all avenues that we can. And certainly these days, social media is one that we are using much more. So that's just some of the ways that we're doing that.
So in your time with the association, have there been any challenges that you've seen?
Well, there are a lot of challenges that people with diabetes face. Certainly, discrimination is one of them, discrimination in the workplace. And one of the things that the association does well, and we have been doing for many years, is we have been advocating to both the provincial and the federal government for more funding. And one of the successes that we had back several years ago in Ontario was covering the cost of insulin pumps. They're very expensive. They're $6,000 to $7,000 for an insulin pump. Plus, on top of that, there's anywhere from $200 to $400 a month in other things needed to run the pump. The really good thing there is that people who are with type 1 diabetes who are using insulin pumps are able to ensure that their blood sugars are very, very regular, and that's, of course, the cause for many complications is the fluctuation in blood sugars. So with new technology and people being able to monitor their blood sugar levels better now, it is really helping people live longer, healthier lives with diabetes, and ensuring that they keep keeping their blood sugar levels very level. The other thing, too, is around type 2 diabetes, one of the things that people face is discrimination. Many people just think, you know, if you ate right and if you exercised, you wouldn't get type 2 diabetes. And while that is clearly a factor in it, we know that at least 50% of people who have type 2 diabetes, it's brought on through genetics. So we all know that we could do better in our lives, whether you have diabetes or not, in eating better and, living a more active lifestyle. So we really encourage people to be careful about their judgment of people with type 2 diabetes, because it's just not as simple as, you know, saying if you ate better, if you're exercised, you wouldn't have it. Again, there are a lot of groups, First Nations groups, people of South Asian background, also a Black background, who are more genetically predisposed to having type 2 diabetes. So again, I think over the years, really trying to get the message out there that diabetes is a devastating disease, and we really need to look at it a different way. So those are a few of the challenges that I think people on a day-to-day basis face with having diabetes.
So when you mention things such as workplace discrimination, can you send a message in regards to this about why this is unacceptable?
Well, we've had a few very high profile incidences, one with one of our rail companies and another with one of the airline companies, where people who were either pilots or engineers on trains were let go simply on the basis of the fact that they had diabetes, not that their diabetes was not in control. So one of the things the association has done is we've gone to bat on an advocacy perspective to, you know, to go to these companies, explain to them how people living with whether it's type 1 or type 2 diabetes can live very healthy, very normal lives with and can very safely conduct whether it be planes or trains type of thing, and been successful in both of those cases. Now, we have many other, probably what we'd say less profile cases, but what we have to do really on a one-off basis is to educate companies, to educate CEOs, to realize that yes, if you have a large company, you are going to have people in your employee who are either type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and recognizing that these people can still live a very full life and be very productive in the workplace, and that diabetes is really no excuse for that kind of discrimination. So these are ongoing things that, that we as an association, really have to face, both at the government level and at the corporate level.
So what are the next steps for the association?
Well, we've just launched a new 5-year plan. And a real focus in there, again, is to ensure that we as an association can reach the now almost 10 million people in Canada who either have diabetes or pre-diabetes. And what we know is people with pre-diabetes, which is elevated blood sugar levels, we know that probably 50% of those people will go on to have full-blown diabetes but what we are trying to teach people is to, modify your lifestyle as best you can. And as you're doing that, we can either delay the onset of type 2 diabetes or in some cases eliminate it completely. So education is really important for us as an association. Also, in the next 5 years, we will be continuing our advocacy efforts to both provincial and federal governments to ensure that they are funding, all new drugs on the formulary that are proven to be effective for people with diabetes. And it does take quite some time to get some of the new drugs that are very effective onto the formulary so that they're covered. So we do that kind of work. We also realize that we want to increase our annual funding to diabetes research. So we certainly have a plan, a very aggressive plan over the next 5 years to increase our revenues significantly so that we can give further revenue again to researchers. And as I said before, Canada has some of the finest diabetes researchers in the world. And of course, we know that our own Dr. Banting, the co-discoverer of insulin, lived right here in London, Ontario. So these are some of the things that we're really pursuing on a going forward basis. We've also, in the last year, developed what we call a diabetes charter, and it's really the rights of people with diabetes in this country. And to date, we've had almost 25,000 people sign this charter, and our goal by the next several months is to have 50,000 people sign this. And we know that this kind of a charter can really have an impact at both our provincial and federal level government officials who are looking at how they're going to spend our healthcare dollars and recognizing that investing in diabetes is extremely important.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Understanding is ever the key to disability life. If more employers and more people in society just take a few minutes to actually share some time with someone with a disability, come to understand what their condition is, what its real impact is, and that this person still has capabilities to learn, grow, work, be a contributing member of society, solve untold numbers of problems. Fact is, willful blindness to understanding is not acceptable. We as a society have a choice, in so much as we can choose to make disabilities our point of contention. We can choose to say someone couldn't do this job on account of their condition. Or, instead of raising that red flag for someone, you can take a moment, see what they can do. As I've heard many, many times, in the workplace, a person with a disability is always likely to give it their best, to put their heart into the work. Why? Because in many cases, they're grateful that somebody actually took some time, took a chance on them. This is never how it should be, in so much as people, such as employers, should give equal consideration to a person with a disability. Look at the skills, not the condition. Look at the capability. Look at a person's background. Ask yourself, does their condition really impact everything they could potentially do? Or would they be an asset to this company? Would they bring something unique? Maybe a new perspective? Fact is, you never learn anything by just having the same perspective recycled over and over. By bringing someone with a disability into the workforce and keeping an open mind, saying to yourself, this is someone who can achieve, this is someone I have faith in, you might find the workforce starts thinking in new ways. They might even just perform a little better, in so much as they're finding out that there are different ways of doing things. Companies and people who can't adapt with changes in time will be forever stuck in a way of thinking that just doesn't work. Understanding and enlightenment go hand in hand. And really, as times change, as technology changes, as medical science advances, we all must keep an open mind. Say, what was once deemed impossible is no longer. Now there is a way. Now there is some hope. And the Diabetes Association, Terry brought up some great points, in my opinion, that cure is always foremost in their thinking, but steps to get there are also taken into consideration. Take a victory where you can get it, folks. If it's not an immediate cure, don't underestimate the importance that taking a step towards one can give you. If the quality of life is improved by a simple thing, or even a complex one, it's still an improvement to the quality of life. What was once painful, hard to do, becomes a little easier. And that reduces the overall strain on a person. And I think we can all agree that in society, there's more than enough stress to go around. But for a person with a disability who sees the work of an association like this one, who sees there are people pushing for these steps, trying to actually make it happen, making manifest our wonderful ideals. That really can be an inspirational thing. The great tragedy is where a group would say, we have all these great ideas, but we're not going to push for the steps to get there. We're just going to let it fall by the wayside. Long-term planning is an essential part of making things happen, but I've always maintained upkeep, maintenance, periodic monitoring. That's critical to making this work. Don't just let it be in the works. Make sure it's going the right direction. Talk to those in the community. See how they feel. Gain an understanding. See step by step until the great puzzle of equality is completed. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.